this week's Larger Than Us episode, we'll be having a conversation about disabilities and how the global South Asian community can both support and advocate for individuals with disabilities. Joining us in our conversation today is Suswathi Basu, a South Asian British journalist and editor, as well as podcast host of How to Be, a books podcast focusing on enhancing mental well-being, self-development, and understanding key societal issues on a global scale. Suswathi is a mental and physical disabilities advocate and an award-winning activist by trade. So welcome, and we're very excited to be talking to you today.
No, thank you for having me. This is a great space, so thank you.
Of course, yeah. So just to get started, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as a journalist and activist?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, thank you. And so background as a journalist, I've been in the media field for 17 years now, so a very long time. Started off training at the BBC, went to The Guardian for several years, and then I ended up in China for 4 years and working as a journalist there, and then eventually coming back and going into broadcast, so TV news for ITV News and then Channel 4 News, and worked as a digital editor in those both those fields. Then I spent 7 years in a bit of a weird detour in AI and counterterrorism, and decided to go back into the media field because it is where my heart lies. And so I was the head of audience and former deputy editor of National World News. So this is where I am now. So 17 years later, back into the journalism sphere. You can't really escape.
No, that's awesome. And you also have a podcast, How to Be. Can you tell us a little bit about the podcast and how did that come to be, and what you kind of what kind of conversations you have on that platform?
So, How to Be. It's actually now How to Be Books, but when it first started, it was very much a outlet for one, having to sort of deal with lots of traumatic events as a journalist, as a also intelligence expert, and having to sort of trying to process a lot of what you're trying to see, and also not feeling helpless all the time. So the podcast was a really good outlet to try and resolve some of those issues and those feelings. But it was a bit of an aversion therapy, which was quite funny because I'm terrible at public speaking, absolutely hate it. So I was like, okay, I need to find a way to use my voice, do a bit of practice. And then I thought, you know, what better way, because I'm absolutely obsessed with reading, is to just sort of amalgamate these different mediums and create something that might be of importance, of resource for other people. So that way I'm just kind of doing all my sort of areas of expertise, activism and journalism, and melding it into one, essentially. So that's really how it came about, and which is why it looks at sort of intersectionality quite a lot, just because I come from multiple identities, and I wanted that reflected in some of the sort of arts that we kind of come across, especially in literature.
Very cool. Yeah, I think it's really cool that you're able to leverage your skills that you do with your daily, with your career, and use it to how you enjoy or how you want to advocate outside of your workplace, which is awesome. I think kind of diving in can you start us off by kind of explaining what kind of defines disability? Because I know when that term is used, depending on the person's perspective, it could mean very different things. And even people who are not necessarily in that community, it can mean a very different perception to them as well. So I think, what does that term mean to you? And if you could tell us a little bit about your journey towards your diagnosis and your background and kind of leading up to it.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct in suggesting that it is very personal to everyone. A lot of people have very different views upon it, you know, and there's also different terminology people prefer to use in terms of being disabled. So I identify as disabled. I say I am disabled, I see it as part of my identity, just like I am South Asian. I am also disabled. So for me, being disabled is just being differently abled. So not being put into the sort of the very tiny box that everyone gets put into, And that's called the social model of disability, which is essentially that there's a tiny 1% box that everyone is supposed to fit into, and that the world is supposed to kind of fit into this box. And so whether you're a any marginalized community automatically gets pushed out of this box. So this also includes things like not having accessible buildings, not having accessible transport. All of these things kind of play into the fact that this box does not fit into this kind of idea, essentially. So that's what disability means for me, which is it's a part of my normal life. But unfortunately, the social model of disability shows that the rest of the world does not kind of look at it in that way. And it's a bit of a social construct in that sense. So for me, it came later in life. So it happened in 2017. So it was very, very quick in terms of how quickly the disability kind of evolved, because I had an underlying condition I was born with, which I wasn't aware of, but the symptoms kind of kicked in when I turned 27. You do the math so you know how old I am. 29 at that time. And then basically overnight, after doing downward dog yoga position, I lost the use of my arms the next day. And I was in Argentina at the time in a bizarre kind of commune. And I was like, okay, this is slightly odd. And the thing is, I've always had really bizarre experiences whilst traveling. So it just kind of, I've took it in my stride and thought it was quite funny and just kind of continued my trip because I was like, I was not going to cut this short. So I spent another week there, even though my arms were gradually just completely going. By the time I got back to London, I realized something was very wrong, because I couldn't hold anything. Nothing was kind of functioning anymore. So I just went to the GP. I thought, you know what, what's happened here? And then they sent me straight to a hospital because they thought I'd had a stroke. But I thought it was quite bizarre because I was just like, I don't think I've had any kind of episode or anything. But it took quite a few months for the diagnosis to come through. But someone did what you call an EMG, an electromagnetic kind of reading, and they saw it straight away, which was the signals from my brain had stopped going into different parts of my body because of my nervous system. So I was like, okay, that's really unusual. And they said, yeah, this is a very, very rare condition called HMPP, which is a hereditary neuropathy with liability to pressure palsy. So quite a mouthful and very rare. And it's sort of a cousin, distant cousin to multiple sclerosis. So I have a lot of the same symptoms as those with MS. And so it just started to progress from there. So first the arms went and they came back eventually, but it took about a year and they're about 70% capacity now. So they never fully came back. And then, so I've lost my motor skills. My fine motor skills are gone. And that means things like holding a pen cannot do. Holding a knife cannot do. So it's a bit annoying, but, you know, this is what it is. And then my legs both started to go as well. That was in 2018. So from time to time, I now need my wheelchair. I use a mobility aid. I walk with a stick. So, yeah, it's a, you know, a progressive disease. So it's just a strange genetic disease that my family has. So it's me, my sister and my mother. And we just all started to progress at the same time. So it was just a very bizarre kind of coincidence. But I've got quite a severe version of it. So, you know, just constant paralysis and things like that is quite sort of common part of it. So, yeah, it's just sort of like since 2017, just kind of finding ways to adapt to the new sort of situation every 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And like to ensure you can still do your best and do anything that you want. Yeah, I feel like I get that. Yeah, thanks for sharing as well. I think one thing that I personally, I also think I'm also personally passionate about is also like the patient care aspect of kind of treating that. And it sounds like you might have a similar experience. I guess, like, for background, I also have an autoimmune condition. And so, and it took, like, very similar to you, like, 4 or 5 years to get to a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of want to just kind of hear your thoughts on in that particular aspect of it. Because patient care oftentimes, I mean, in the US here, it's not very empathetic. And I'm sure it's very similar in the UK as well, where you're going through so much, you're going through episodes and things like that, and you're going through a lot of pain, but a lot of times doctors don't necessarily give you the necessarily tests, treatments. You have to justify yourself, I feel like, a lot of times, mm-hmm. And advocate for yourself in that situation. So I guess when you were earlier, like, getting more of these symptoms, what was your experience with that, and how did you find a way to advocate for yourself or get, like, the care that you need, or ask your doctors to give you the right access to the tests and things like that that you needed, and medication in that early process, just to kind of help share with our listeners, if they're in a similar situation, how they can kind of leverage those methods to kind of get the care that they would need.
Yeah, Kirsty, I went through exactly the same process. I was, in a way, very lucky at the beginning, where the diagnosis came really quickly because someone identified it. So the EMG consultant was the one who identified it almost straight away. He was like, oh, that looks like that. And he happened to know the condition. And again, it's such a rarity for that to happen. But it's the follow through. After that, there's very much like, okay, so you've got this diagnosis, but then what? And unfortunately, with a lot of chronic conditions, it just tends to get left, because if it's not terminal, they do not care. And that's kind of the reaction I had from a lot of the consultants. And I'm part of a 1,000-strong Facebook group who deals with the specific condition. So we talk a lot with each other about the condition, which is really helpful, because we share a lot of patient care information in that sense. And we have access to the top doctor and specialist in the world regarding the condition. But we've had to create that space for each other, because that didn't exist before, and we were just all screaming in the dark as a result of that. And you know, everyone has had the same experience, in sense of going to a specialist and being just fobbed off for saying no, it's either everything is because of the condition or nothing is because of the condition.
Yeah.
And that is really problematic, because there's such little understanding, especially if you have even like an autoimmune disease. You know, you're aware, I'm sure, that either everything gets equated to it or nothing does. And so I think that's been very problematic in terms of trying to just sort of advocate for your rights. In the beginning, I was completely alone, and you know, I don't have family support or anything, so I was very much alone dealing with it. And one thing I found really quickly was trying to make your space for it, which is, first of all, getting friends on board, getting people who, you know, who can support you in some shape or form, whether that's just on a kind of a daily basis or on a just weekly basis, things like just basic things where you need help at home. So, yes, so I would really recommend finding your people, the people that can help you with your everyday sort of tasks. You know, I was very lucky. I had a good group of friends. They would help come and clean, cook, wash my hair, did absolutely everything, which was great in the sort of the day-to-day aspect. If you've got family, that's even better. You know, they can assist with those kind of things, and that is really helpful. From a patient care perspective, it's really good, especially if you've got issues with maybe recording things and you're in pain and things like that. Bring someone with you. You know, it is, you know, bring someone you trust with you. They can stay there. They can also take notes if you'd like. They can ask questions on your behalf. You know, so I would totally recommend bringing someone in and keeping them along in that journey as well. Just kind of keeping them abreast of different changes that are happening, things that you need. It's really important that you find an advocate for yourself when you can't advocate for other people, but also finding your group of people. If you find that you've got a condition like this, just like I've mentioned, which is, you know, we've got more than 1,000 people across the world who talk to each other on a daily basis, who have the same condition, the same symptoms, various sort of conversations where they just don't understand, different symptoms are coming up. And just having a conversation, you know, like, is this normal? Is this okay? It's really important to share that information. if you've got health specialists, are they good? You know, is it worth maybe sharing their information so someone else could then also get that health specialist? So we've done that, you know, it's fantastic. We've all kind of shared our expertise in the area, things that we've learned. So really, it's really important with patient care is find your people, find your specialists, and find your advocate.
I mean, kind of going off that a little bit, I know you, we've talked a lot about, you talked a lot about how one should advocate for themselves in these situations. To kind of kind of opposite of that, what can we do to keep our healthcare systems accountable for some of the things that they're doing? Like what kind of changes do you see should be implemented into our healthcare systems in the UK, in the US, globally, that could then advocate for individuals with disabilities in going in the future? What are some changes that the system can start integrating or should start integrating in order to account for these problems and issues?
Okay, so this is a much larger issue. It's not as simple, unfortunately, as like individual doctors and things like that, because, you know, I'm sure just like the US, in the UK, it's completely stretched. It's at the end of its tether, the system is like collapsing. And so it's about not having enough funding for that system and not having enough support for those people, those nurses, those staff members. We're basically hemorrhaging. And so, you know, we've got a huge brain drain in this country with our medical staff. So what we need is fundamentally more funding for the system for them to be able to support their patients. A lot of doctors, unfortunately, just don't have enough time. They sit there for 10 minutes with their patient and then they have to get to the next one. That is not enough time for one person, you know, when you have multiple problems all the time. So there is a fundamental problem there. And unfortunately, it is a lot larger than, you know, the individual doctor. But there are always complaint procedures. If you feel like you are not getting the healthcare that you deserve, there are complaint procedures. In the UK, it's called PALS. There are ombudsmen in the UK, and I believe that's the same in the US. So do use those systems in place to chase those up, because I don't believe you should let it go if you're not getting the healthcare that you deserve and that you're paying for, especially in the US. Then absolutely, you've got to hold them accountable.
Part of it is also, like, I think the training too, like the approach, very much here it is like you've mentioned before, it's like the checklist. You have to have that textbook diagnosis in order for them to be like, yes, you do have that. Now let's start giving you medication and whatnot. But it's also, I think also like that textbook was derived from like white people. Yeah. it really was. Those symptoms on like brown women, like I don't, like, those don't, they show very differently in me in the same condition that they're looking at. And I think that insensitivity of being, I think that's like another, I think just starting there too, it's like, it's just, it needs to be like ingrained in, I think, the education system of how we're even also bringing up doctors or certifying them is definitely something that needs to change. Especially because we're so diverse, even like in the US, I'm sure in the UK too.
I'm like, Kirthi, I'm like, you know, I went to see Adam Kay the other day. He's a very famous comedian, former surgeon, actually. He wrote a very famous book called This Is Going to Hurt. And, you know, he was talking about there's a fundamental problem in the medical system, which is they don't see doctors as human beings. And so they almost become numb to a lot of what they're supposed to be doing. Like they were discussing things like having a body, you know, cut open in front of them. They were just told you're just going to have to suck it up and do it. And so they stop treating patients like human beings because they basically tell them this is the only way you're going to be able to deal with this job, which is you've got to dehumanize the people that you work with in order for you to keep going on to the next person to save lives. But that's a fundamental problem, because then it creates other issues like mental health problems within the medical system. And the suicide rate in mental health, the suicide rate within the medical system is unbelievably high. So, you know, you've got so many layers within the medical system of why they behave a certain way. But then on top of it, you've got the other aspect, which is, you know, Black women have the worst ratings of like how they're treated, you know, absolutely dehumanized beyond belief, because, you know, this is a historical issue for, you know, hundreds of years where women, Black women specifically, have been treated like they don't even matter. And, you know, the maternity rates in this country is horrific, how Black women are treated in the UK. And, you know, and South Asian women are an extension of that. Every time we come with problems, it's seen as emotional. It's not like taken seriously, you know, and you've got the essentially the double prong of being a woman. And then on top of it, being a South Asian woman or a woman of color or woman of a global majority. And so you've just got these layers upon layers of issues within the system that's built up. And essentially, we're going to have to tear it apart and start all over again with it. There's just so many problems with it.
Yeah, and on the other flip end, I don't know if it's just like the people that I've experienced with the community that I have. I feel like in the South Asian community that I'm a part of, it's very like respectable to be a doctor in the sense of like whatever the doctor says, you gotta listen to it because they're smarter on you on this. So even if it's maybe not the most judgment best call to go after, or maybe like for example like starting on like a lifelong steroid like medication is a very important decision, or even birth control if you're not talking about like chronic illnesses, like we just gotta do it if the doctor says so, like mm-hmm. That's like the type of mindset that's always walking into. That was one of the roadblocks I had to personally as well like have to go around when I was first figuring my stuff out. But like, and I think that as well, and with specifically in our community, like I think they're over revered, and I think that also with like the dehumanizing, it's kind of like a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, I come from a South Asian background where it's a Hindu background, and there is a hierarchical status, you know, an order. So things like mm-hmm. people who are in those kind of jobs anyways, essentially it's like a caste system within itself. So people are like, we must listen to these people who are telling us what to do, even though it might be completely nonsensical. So I think even within the structure, there's an ingrained sort of system of like, we must follow those who have better education or this, that, the other, even though it doesn't always show as you've seen. And I think, you know, I was looking at a video by Dr. Atul Gawande, who's a very prominent doctor in the US. He wrote a very great book called Being Mortal, and it's about death. And he talks about even when he was at the peak of his career, even he was making mistakes. Like he kept telling his father, who was dying at that point, you know, let's just keep him on chemo. Let's keep him going through this. And his father was like, no, I don't want to do this. That's ridiculous. He said, I've got like 6 months to go. He said, no, we'll do 2 rounds of chemo. You'll be fine. You'll be playing tennis again. And he said, even when I thought about it in my head, I was like, that's impossible. And I think that even they get also sucked into like, oh, I'm also very important. And so they have to deconstruct as well.
I mean, I guess kind of going into the stigmatization of disability in terms of like how society perceives individuals with disability. I don't know. Why do you think disabilities are stigmatized so much in society? And do you think there's any like difference between how physical disabilities are perceived versus mental disabilities by the general public?
Yeah, it's just massive. It's massive. I've been, you know, in both systems. I've been, you know, in both systems, so I know exactly the differences and the similarities. Having a physical disability is one of those strange things where it's just like, it's almost like, oh, we get it. We understand you've got this problem. So we were just like, okay, here's a treatment. This is the solution. But the problem is that it also reduces people's identities. So, you know, there've been many times where I'll be walking on the street with my stick or in my wheelchair. I have people coming up to me and say, I'll pray for you. And it's like, that's very offensive because this is just who I am. It's like, and I've always questioned them and I've said, would you pray for me just because I'm brown as well? Because that's exactly what you're saying. So I think that's also problematic, first of all, which is to see it as a problem. You know, some people are able to live with it and some people can't. And that's the fundamental issue with disability, which is it's always been seen as needed to be cured. And that's as far back as maybe, you know, like even just 50 years ago, you know, a lot of people with disabilities were just locked up and locked away from society and not seen, because, you know, then they won't have to deal with it. So it's still a, you know, a very new concept. And then when you bring about mental health, which is a whole other thing, there is absolutely no understanding around mental health, because it is treated the same way, which is it needs to have a cure. So, you know, medication is seen as like the first thing, as most doctors do, because they think just like a physical ailment, it needs to be scientifically treated in the same way. It's not like that. It's a very complex, sort of situation, you know, whether it's emotional, whether it's biological, it's hard to say what it is, but it is lifelong. So, you know, especially if you've got an actual diagnosed condition in mental health. So that's the problem, which is, and mental health was even, I think, less than 50 years ago, people were locked up away and just from society. And that's not a long time ago. That isn't a long time ago. I'm like, only just the pandemic, people started really talking about mental health in a sort of a really big way. And that was 2 years ago. You know, I started up the a global employee resource group for my company, because I was just like, it seems really ridiculous that people are struggling and they are having to work every day, but they cannot share this massive part of themselves, even though they're struggling. And also I developed a physical and mental health and neurodivergent and, you know, a whole kind of encompassing group where we could all come together, share issues, talk about these issues, you know, where people were really struggling. And the pandemic just made it like 100 times worse. So, you know, it's just absolutely insane that, you know, the completely wrong word for that, but it's bizarre that we're still having to think about this as a completely sort of backwards way, because at the, you know, we've come a lot, you know, further in terms of how we treat women, how we treat people of color, but people with mental health and disabilities is still very much, you know, very much stigmatized within society, even though it's the fifth of the world's population, at least. So we're talking in the billions. So it is really ridiculous that we still don't have any proper understanding of either.
Kind of going off, like, the whole mental disability versus physical disability, like, I think with mental disabilities as well, and learning disabilities in certain situations, I think there is, like, a tendency to, like, if you're not experiencing it at this moment, how bad could it be? If I can't visually see that you're struggling, then how bad can it really be? And there's this mentality in society that exists, and I think it puts a lot of pressure on people with mental disabilities to then have to constantly justify that I need accommodations, or there's a lot more chance for people to struggle in silence when it comes to mental disability, and not even really having, maybe not even really understanding the language to articulate some of the issues, because it's not something that people in the medical field are, in a professional sense, talk about in a regular manner and actually know how to diagnose and diagnose properly. It's still, you know, a growing body of research. And it's interesting to see that kind of distinction between mental and physical disabilities, because, I mean, I just feel like that everyone should be more empathetic towards any disability, regardless of what it might be. But it just seems like something that everyone is struggling to comprehend. We're at a point where everyone is willing to talk about it and willing to have the conversation, but not really understanding how to implement that into practice and everyday sort of life.
Yeah, and mental health is often treated a lot like an invisible disability, you know, in the sense that, you know, if you can't see it, then basically it doesn't exist and you're making it up. And that's really problematic because it can't be defined away in a textbook. It's not that simple. Even the, you know, there's a lot of things like borderline personality disorder, complex post-traumatic stress disorder. They're finding new literature on both all the time, saying that actually a lot of women who've been diagnosed with BPD, which is extremely common, actually have complex post-traumatic stress disorder instead. But because they cannot understand or sort of the symptoms, collective symptoms around post-traumatic stress disorder, it just gets automatically labeled as BPD, and BPD has a massive stigma, as we've seen with the, say, the Johnny Depp Amber Heard case, where she was absolutely vilified for having BPD. I think that's really problematic. You know, we've got like these people being treated terribly for having these conditions, and it's very unfair. You know, so I think there's still so much work to be done.
Yeah, it's surprising that it's not a priority or as seen as a priority, like you mentioned. Like, I didn't know that 5% of the population or billions of people have these struggles. And that's like a lot of people. Like, to me, if I heard that and heard like kind of parallel that with the things that are going on, it's like very alarming. So I didn't know that. And to me, it's just like, dang.
Yeah, like 17% of the population in the UK has a disability. A fifth of the world's population has a disability. That's a huge amount. And that's, you know, disability, whether it's mental health or physical health. But we know for a fact it's a lot more, because mental health is never, ever talked about. So actually, you know, you can say, given on a day-to-day basis, people have a spectrum of mental health. They're on the spectrum of mental health, whether they're doing better, whether they're doing less. You know, an actual diagnosed illness with mental health is different, but then everyone is on a spectrum. So it is, you know, so it is kind of shocking that there isn't that much sort of emphasis put on it. But again, it's one of those things. If it's not terminal, they will not deal with it.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, on the accommodations perspective, more like, because I know we've talked a little bit about like the diagnosis aspect, do you see that kind of improving? As I mean, I'm assuming the pandemic might have had some acceleration to that, but do you see that improving, or is there still a lot of like gaps that we need to address?
There's still huge gaps. I'm like, so I am an ambassador for BEAT, which is eating disorder. It's a national eating disorder charity in the UK. So the rates of people calling with eating disorders skyrocketed during the pandemic. Like, it went up like 200%. And that just showed that actually there's a lot of people out there that needs the support, but not enough support. That's the problem. So I think there's still so much money, funding that needs to be put towards the correct places to be able to address this. And we're not there yet. We are not there yet. And to be fair, even after the pandemic, it's already starting to drop off. We've seen things like, you know, remote working is already starting to be rolled back. Lots of people are asking people to come back into work, you know, full time into like a work setting. But a lot of people need those remote settings. They need to have that flexibility for mental health reasons, whether they have a physical disability, but it's not even being considered. So we know already all of those things are starting to be rolled back anyways.
I guess kind of going off that a little bit, I mean, do you think that different cultures may perceive and understand disabilities in different ways? Like, for example, like, you know, hyper-individualistic Western cultures versus more like, you know, Eastern cultures that are more like groupthink and collaborative thinking and community-based thinking. Do you think there's like a difference in the way that disability is perceived in that way, both either physical or mental?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's, you know, I've been in lots of different kinds of communities, and you know, in the South Asian community, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. You know, there's still very much an element, if you are physically disabled or even if you have a mental health problem, that, again, it's one of those things. It's like you are cursed that you've had that, you know, and there's a lot of stigma around superstition around having a disability, which is, you know, you've done something wrong in your life and therefore you've you've actually ended up this way, which I think is a really still really, really bad way to think about it. And so as a result, a lot of people with disabilities are still treated like, you know, this is wrong and this shouldn't have happened to you. And so there's still a lot of issues regarding that kind of cultural side of it. In the West, it's the other side of it where it's just like, because it's such an individualistic kind of mentality, you just basically fall through the cracks. You know, wealth, there is no social welfare, not proper social welfare for people or jobs or things like that. For people who have disabilities or no flexibility when it comes to that, because of a really hyper-capitalist society. And so there's the other side of it, which is you become very lonely and you basically fall through the social welfare cracks within the Western system. In a South Asian community, I've had to face, which is this other notion, which is I'll find cures for your condition. And I think both ways, there still needs to be a middle ground and needs to change.
Yeah, I think we spoke a little bit about this earlier when you were talking about when you found the need to develop an ERG within your workplace and kind of start those conversations. And I think that goes really well hand in hand with the next question of kind of seeing what are some of the issues within the workplace. We talked about like, kind of like all the pandemic stuff rolling back. How do you think managers or even like leaders in the workplace can facilitate like a healthy work environment for those individuals? Like how can we kind of ingrain that to be a more permanent way of going about it rather than like a situational, like I feel like you mentioned before, like the pandemic was like, we got to work remote. We have to stay away from each other. So these things were in place and now it's starting to roll back now as things are quote unquote normal. So, like, how can we kind of facilitate that conversation in, like, the area, like, in our professional environment to make sure that these things stay permanent and, like, kind of ingrain it in the way that we do things in the workplace?
It has to come from the top down. That's really fundamental because, you know, individual managers might want to just, you know, create an environment, a safe space for people to be able to communicate their feelings about whether they're having issues and things like that. But if there is no support and there is this constant need to perform, hit metrics, hit targets at the expense of people, then basically that's where all these situational kind of quotas develop. You know, we saw that through not just through the pandemic, but through the horrific murder of George Floyd. There was a huge backlash to, you know, like, oh, we need to have much more sort of DEI culture within organizations. But it was very reactionary. You know, these problems have been going on for decades, you know. People are watching horrific things on a regular basis. People are dealing with horrific things on a regular basis. But, you know, until a big situation like that happens, basically organizations will not do anything. And so first of all, we need to kind of take it out of a quota system, so to speak, and, you know, a HR kind of functionality. It needs to be kind of ingrained into the entire organization rather than just, oh, HR doing this from time to time, you know celebrating Black History Month from time to time, and, you know, there is no real kind of change. So I think, again, and that comes from the top down. That kind of culture has to come from the top down. Otherwise, it's just falling on deaf ears. You'll have just managers screaming in the wind and nothing changes. And so I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of sort of these kind of schemes that are around. You know, we have one in the UK called Disability Confident. People get a stamp on their company. So it allows people with disabilities to see that what this company could actually, you know, employ people with disabilities, but also have accessible features within their companies as a result. But the thing is that the companies need to actually put this through all of their systems, and they don't. And they don't get chased up either by the government organizations either. So, you know, we have a lot of lip service still in that sense. So it has to come from within the company, from the top down, and otherwise nothing will change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Accountability is definitely needed. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was about to say, how do you, I guess, because a lot of times I think leaders don't emphasize or prioritize it because they themselves don't see it as a priority. So how can, I guess, an individual tell their leaders this is a priority that needs to be focused on, and to help make sure that they can hold their own organization accountable? Because that's a lot of the times the main problems with like organizations, and especially with the corporate world, not like in a lot of different scenarios.
Being the cynic that I am, I think the best way to actually to hold people accountable is to actually showcase how these kind of initiatives can help the company. So by having a, say, more productive workforce, by having less people taking days off because of the support that they get, and, you know, showcasing the numbers behind it actually is probably the best way you'll ever get anything through. Because they are numbers people. They're looking for how this will benefit the company. Because unfortunately, with these kind of corporations, you know, it's very much like they need to see how it benefits them. And if it means having to showcase essentially why it's really beneficial to help a workforce succeed and therefore have less absences, that is a way to actually showcase it, and they will actually ingrain it into the system as a result.
I think that's so important to talk about, specific, like the how to change aspect of it. And I think you've really like kind of captured, like, I guess, operationally speaking, how the workplace can change and how these systems can change in order to accommodate and to provide accommodations for individuals with disability in terms of infrastructure. So I'm studying to become an architect. So can't call myself an architect legally because that would have implications. I'll call myself an architectural designer. The idea of, I guess, human-centered design has become a huge conversation within the industry. And, you know, that could include providing like specific infrastructure to accommodate for disability or people with disabilities, whether that be mental or physical. In your opinion, what can, you know, designers and architects and planners build into the built environment to then improve the environment for individuals?
Yeah, I mean, there's huge sort of changes that need to be done. I'm like, I was quite lucky because I had sort of a blueprint between the before and the after, which was really lucky. So the before was that, for example, I worked in, you know, one of those very fancy communal buildings where, you know, big companies and things like that. But they had a fundamental flaw, which is if you're on a walking stick, you can't hold anything. So I had maybe a mug in my hand. I would not be able to open a door because I would need a pass to go through. So I was just like, okay, so I would have to rely on someone each time to either open the door or bring me drinks. So that was already a fundamental flaw in that system. Also, there was no proper fire sort of exits and hazards for people who can't walk up and down stairs, which I can't. So I was just like, okay, so what would be the case? And they said, you know, we would have to sort of take you down a special chair and things like that, or like carry you on our backs or something. I was like, well, that's just really ridiculous, isn't it? And then when we moved into the new building, it was a fully new building, and they had told the people building the building that there would be changes, we would need to have accessible spaces. First of all, the doors were made a lot bigger so they could fit a wheelchair. There was a disabled toilet right next to the office. That was huge. You know, I've got like gut issues and things like that, so I need to have access to a toilet. And things like they had a fire escape room specifically designed for people who cannot walk up and down stairs. All the doors did not require a pass. I was able to use like a special disabled kind of button so I can actually get through. So all these little things make a fundamental difference to just your day-to-day going into work. And with mental health, there needs to be, and also people who are neurodivergent need to have quiet spaces, you know, need to have spaces where it's just completely, you know, soundproof, blocked, dark, you know, and so there needs to be booths like that. And in the new building, there were. So they'd already made some fundamental differences, you know, changes just by having that kind of feedback. But one of the biggest issues I see generally is that accessible consultants are used as an afterthought. So after they've created an entire blueprint, then they'll bring the accessible consultants in. So a good example is that a local tube station down where I am basically brought in the accessible consultants after they'd built the tube station. And something as simple as a wheelchair going into a lift, they realized there wasn't enough timing. The time was too quick. So he kept bashing into the door and the door kept closing on him. So, you know, it's simple things like that. It's just make sure the accessible consultants are there from the beginning when you're building something.
Yeah, I think that's something that's definitely trying to be worked on at the moment. And it's difficult because it is codified in the ADA, right? So there is a huge document for anyone who's is not familiar. The ADA is the Disabilities Act, and it basically lists out very specifically the building code that is required in order to make a building accessible. But like you said, it is very much an afterthought. You know, you're designing and you're creating and you're whatever, but then when it comes to who can access this building, it, you know, ramps are put in after you design the stairs, you know. Railing is added as a necessity, and almost as, you know, you're kind of at, you, there's a lot of like, even in the office, like, oh, I'm annoyed, I have to, you know, start accommodating for ADA stuff now. And there's this like anxiety to do that. And I think there is a conversation that is being had that, and it's not, again, this aspect is not codified, right? It's based on architect and based on designer and based on the firm and who you work with, based on city. You know, certain cities are more more open to having that conversation and having those changes be integrated. And then there's other cities that not so much, you know? So yeah, it is interesting. It's always interesting to hear like from the people who are going to be using it and getting their perspective, because I think otherwise, you know, it's just there's no restrictions, and developers can basically cut corners when it comes to these kind of things, and it's just not not conducive of a good environment. So
it's the same as like greenwashing, yeah. You know, when it comes to sustainable buildings, it's exactly the same thing. But I always see it as a way to be more innovative. Yeah. You have to kind of think outside the box when you bring in these extra things or make those kind of changes. And I think it's more exciting in a way, because you're having to do something completely like different, but you have to have those kind of structures built in. So I think if people kind of saw it in a different lens, that actually this is an opportunity to try something completely new. Just like with sustainability, you know, it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And yeah, it definitely should. And I mean, I'm hoping that it can also start integrating. I mean, there's a whole nother, I guess, rant I could go on about how the education system within how architecture is taught in studios is very much has not evolved in the last 30, 40 years. And I think these kind of things rules or standards that need to be set while we're being taught these things as well. But yeah, I could go on a rant. I won't. We should move on to the next question.
No, but yeah, speaking about mindset, I think that's something kind of like that you spoke about earlier in the episode with multiple different ways, like changing the language, changing the way we think about certain things or approach certain processes. On that note, what are some common or little maybe known misconceptions or ableist language that you have maybe experienced, or you know that is a kind of like something that is like a recurring thing that people do experience? And how can we keep ourselves and our peers accountable for ensuring that they don't speak in that way, or how we can correct them so that everybody's a little bit more empathetic to each other and we kind of start to try to change the language around that, around those types of misconceptions?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's like it has to be an open dialogue. I think it's very easy to kind of shoot someone down for saying some of the wrong things. Mm-hmm. I think it's just like an educational moment, where it's just like a learning moment where, you know, I hear it all the time. People use language like, oh, my blind spot, and things like that. And, you know, all of these are, you know, ableist language. And the thing is, it's like, you might not notice it straight away, but someone might notice it and they will just be like, oh, you know, you've just said that word. And then maybe they'll be like, oh yeah, sorry. You know, I might say it once or twice, and they will be open about it and say, I might say it once or twice by accident, but eventually it will come out of my lexicon because language is always evolving. And so I think, you know, that's really important, which is have a dialogue when it comes to, okay, you know, maybe that doesn't work anymore. It's just not suitable anymore. And it's okay to make a mistake. You know, we're really, you know, it's a privilege to know lots of trans women, non-binary people, trans men, and to be able to understand, okay, I need to make sure that my language is, you know, absolutely adequate to address people. And so, you know, being careful and things like that is exactly the same thing, where it's just having this dialogue and being like, okay, I'm going to make a few mistakes, but I will try my best to just keep evolving and changing my language. We're just going to keep learning. And I think that's the same with ableist language as well, which is, it's very common. We've been using a lot of, you know, ableist language for a very long time. Again, it's part of sort of, you know, even like, I think just even 10 years ago, people were still using the R word, which I will not mention. And, you know, it's such an awful word to use for people with mental health issues or, you know, learning difficulties. And, you know, and the thing is, it was never really acceptable, but obviously people are just saying, do not ever say that word. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really important, which is having that conversation and having that sort of teaching moments, like, this isn't okay anymore. But, you know, perhaps just, you know, stop saying it from next time, but not to be like really aggressive about it, because it's like everything is evolving at the moment. Everything is changing and people's mentality is changing. And I think, you know, I'm learning something new every day, and I think, you know, everyone is. And so it's really important to just be like, okay, you know, we are going to keep learning. We are learning beings. So, you know, I think that's a really important way to sort of look about it, which is, do not vilify people, but, you know, teach them.
Right. Yeah. And kind of going off on that, in the South Asian community, it's very similar to what you kind of mentioned before in some of your experiences, when people are like, I will pray for you, or, oh, I'm so sorry you're going through this, like that type of terminology. I feel like that's very what goes on in the South Asian community in terms of the dialogue around this. I guess, is there any other things that kind of like that, and how could we, I guess, in that community, like, kind of approach that? Just because I feel like in that setting or environment, it's harder to be like, all right, let's make this a learning experience, just because oftentimes it's coming from someone older than you, or someone like, it's just coming from a different estate where, like, it's a catch 22. How do I address this? But you're older than me and I can't correct you.
No, I get that. Cause, you know, this is a conversation I have with so many, say, like Uber drivers, even, you know, they're much older than me. But what they're like, oh, what's wrong with you? It's usually the first thing they'll say. Because when they see a stick, it's just immediately, oh, you've had an accident. Mm. You're young. So why is this the case? Mm. So I think I'll just usually say, there's nothing wrong with me. I was just like, I have a condition. Then you get the next phase of it, which is, oh no, what happened to you? What is this? And it's sort of like, it's just sort of explaining that actually, you know, it's just part of life. This is just the way it is. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. It's just part of who I am. And I think that's really important. And I've had these conversations with older South Asian people, which is like, no, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm absolutely fine. It's who I am. It makes me who I am. And, you know, I've learned so much as a result of that. I've learned about other people's experiences as a result of that. It allows me to understand other people, understand, you know, maybe different things about what I need to do. And so I think talking about it in that way is always really useful, which is to be like, okay, this has helped me because. And I think it gives people an idea that, oh, okay, this is just part of their everyday life. This is just like, you wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth. This is who you are. And I think that's the way I tend to explain it to people, which is, it's just part of who I am. Just like I am South Asian, just like I am a woman. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I explain it to people. And they seem to sort of understand, oh, okay, I get it. Just means I have a different life lens and life point of view as a result of it.
I think that's super important too, because it also positions yourself as more than your disability, right? It positions yourself as someone who has passions and goals and have nothing to do with whatever condition you might be going through. And I feel like that, again, just, I think the way that you put that, I think that's very good to put out there, because I think there is a lot of people in society in general that like to do that regardless of what it is, whether it be disability, whether it be your South Asian, or whether it be you're a woman. That's the first thing they see, and that's the only thing they see, and we need to start changing that collectively, I think. And I think that's super important. I guess, like, I mean, and you've been such a huge advocate of having these conversations and pushing the narrative forward. Can you tell us a little bit about the conversations you've been facilitating and working on addressing in your, you know, Clubhouse and Twitter Space platforms? What kind of work have you been doing there? And can you just, I guess, give a little brief on that?
So I spent a year like creating this Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces, where basically, you know, I realized that, again, most of what I'm reading in the podcast and things like that are things that I actually want to know about. So, you know, for me, I'm a lifelong learner. You know, I'm a student of life. And so I will always want to hear about other people's point of views. I don't believe I have the answers for everything, and I don't believe the writers have the answers for everything either. So what those spaces are for is for people to give their opinion about the subject without judgment, without any kind of like prejudice, and for people to kind of respectfully kind of think about each other's point of view. So those Twitter spaces and the Clubhouse, for example, you know, one week we'd be talking about, okay, what does break, like a heartbreak look like for you? Like, what does that mean? Does that truly look like? And it's different for everyone, and everyone's experiences are valid. And I think that's why it was so popular, because actually it gave people a space to be open about difficult subjects. And I think that was really helpful, because, and as a result, you know, lots of people got on board, you know, made lots of friends as a result through that. And they came every week, you know, wanting to talk about a new subject, something difficult. You know, how are they resilient one week? How do they manage confidence? How do they manage, you know, sort of the day-to-day kind of grief? How do they deal with heartbreak and things like that? So I think those subjects, sometimes we don't really talk about it, especially even with friends, close friends. It's not even a subject people are comfortable talking about. But because it's a space, it's an audio space, there was something slightly different about it. It gave people an opportunity to not sit there and type on their phone an answer, which is very common, you know, especially in lots of different kind of group settings, you know, so WhatsApp groups, Discord, things like that. In an audio setting, there's one level more intimacy in there. You can hear people's voices, how they sound. You know, timbre, context gives you big, it's very different to a sort of written group. And for one, you can also do something else at the same time as you're doing it. And it allowed a lot more people to come in and have a chat as a result. And it was very kind of informal, but it also gave them a space to share their opinions and realize that they're also valid as well. So it's a really kind of special space that was created as a result of that. And it was a fantastic community.
I 100%, I think that's so amazing that you kind of have been able to facilitate those conversations. And as we talk in the broader context, it is so important to have these conversations with people and keep pushing the narrative forward. And I guess as a final question, because we are nearing the end of our episode here, what are some ways in which people in the South Asian community, or, you know, even in the broader community as a whole, can advocate for individuals with disability, either mental or physical?
I think it's good to actually reach out, to different groups. There are already existing groups, but you know, and so it's a really great way to kind of look into different spaces and seeing what people do. You know, so for example, you know, we don't have a specific South Asian one for arts as such, but we have something called Cryptic Art, which is a creative space for people with disabilities. And there's like writing workshops, there's like theater performance, things like that. So there are these spaces. So if you're seeing that, support them, you know, go and see the shows, listen to, go to an open mic, listen to people. And I think it's really important to hear those different experiences, and, you know, hear the way they kind of portray that. And I think it's really beautiful, especially in an art form, to actually support people. And it gives you a kind of a tangible medium to support someone. So, you know, if it's, whether it's like an open mic night, it's a book, it's, you know, an article online, read it, you know. This, I think, is really important, which is be an advocate, not necessarily an ally, but be an advocate, you know, be active. I think that's really important for any community, let alone the South Asian community. So, you know, we exist, people with disabilities exist, they're all over, they're all around. And so just give them your love, give them your support, see them, make them visible. And again, I recommend the book by Alice Wong, which is Disability Visibility. And she runs a fantastic, you know, group of people, and that anthology is fantastic. But Disability Visibility is also a really important creative disabled art space in the US. So, you know, there are these spaces, so look for them.
Awesome. Yeah, and with that, thank you so much, Cicely, for coming on and sharing your perspective and your experiences. I definitely think there were a lot of great takeaways, advice, and things that we can kind of think about after this episode. And I'm sure the listeners can resonate that with that as well. So I guess also thank you again to our listeners for tuning in and sticking with us to the very end of the conversation. If you would like to get in touch with Cicely about her ongoing advocacy efforts towards the disability community, as well as her podcast, How to Be, we'll put all of her contact information and her platform and social media in the description in the episode description. So please stay connected with her and let us know your thoughts on the episode. And yeah, thank you again, Cicely, for your time.
Thank you both. Thank you, Sneha Kirti. I really appreciate it.